but the 3rd New Jersey would prevail. It was the youngest of the three regiments of the New Jersey line, having been commissioned on the first day of 1776, 3 months after the first two Jersey regiments had been formed. Nevertheless, it was quite experienced, fighting in more than half a dozen campaigns, including the Battle of Monmouth, where Alex himself had been injured. It was a typical Continental regiment consisting of 8 companies, each with 90 soldiers and a captain. The plan was to go south. Reliable intelligence had it that General Henry Clinton, the commander-in-chief of British forces in North America, had sailed south in December at the head of a massive army of over 8,500 men. General Clinton was believed to have been in Savannah since early in the year, where he had been joined by Generals Cornwallis and Rawdon, who had swelled the British forces to 14,000 men. It appeared the British general had his sights set on taking the crucial city of Charleston, which, in addition to its trading importance, was also garrisoned to some 5,000 Continental troops. Colonel Hamilton and the men of the 3rd New Jersey, in conjunction with 7 other regiments, would sail to South Carolina and establish a second American position on Sullivan's Island, where in 1776 Colonel Moultrie had successfully defended Charleston against a far smaller British force. The second garrison would make it impossible for Clinton to lay siege to the forces inside Charleston proper without exposing his rear flank to constant ambushes by the American forces at Fort Moultrie. She was going to marry someone else. Someone with a name, a family, and a fortune. Of course she was. He had to forget about her. He had 728 men under his command. At first, they were no more than a list of names on sheets of paper. But as he perused the litany of Alcotts and Kilkellys and Williamsons, the Josiahs and Ezekiels and Franklins, Alex had a sense of the awesome responsibility that had been placed in his hands. Each of these men was someone's son, someone's brother, someone's husband, someone's future. And all of them would be risking their lives at his sole discretion. Alex's wisdom would be their salvation, his folly would be their death. When he got the word from General Washington, Alex poured his heart out to his friend Lawrence. "May I say, the news of an imminent reunion with my dearest friend is the only thing that consoles me during these dreary days, when I am separated from my adored Eliza not just by a distance of some hundreds of miles, but by the dispiriting prospect of her marriage to that bounder, Henry Livingston. Dispiriting, I write, as if I were talking about a loss at cards or a poor yield from an orchard. The truth is, John, I am crushed. So dismal am I that I have bethought myself to decline General Washington's commission on the grounds that I am not fit to assume responsibility for the lives of 700 of our boys when I care not a whit for my own. If I had my druthers right now, I would not lead these brave lads, but fight amongst them as one of them. I would charge the enemy line with my bayonet outstretched, and gorge myself on British blood till they were all strewn about me like a covey of partridge happened upon by a rabid dog, or until I myself was gored and fallen. Indeed, I sometimes think it better that I die in the upcoming battle, so that Eliza may be free of me, and not have the regret of not marrying me to compound the woes of what I cannot help but conceive of as a difficult marriage. And yet, it is a marriage that I have no right to contest, for I have not the fortune nor the name to claim her as my own. Lawrence, the fighting cannot come soon enough. And yet, he would still have to wait a little longer. During the course of the long winter, one of Alex's many tasks was negotiating with Wilhelm von Niephausen, a general in the army of England's Hessian allies, and the erstwhile commander of British-held New York City in General Clinton's absence, over a plan for an exchange of prisoners of war. After Clinton's departure to South Carolina, Alex began corresponding with the German general. Both sides claimed to long for the prisoner exchange, yet during the 4.5 years of fighting, no steps forward had been made. By this point, each side held thousands of prisoners, which was onerous for the captors, but excruciating and often fatal for the captives. King George, in violation of the rules of war, had gone so far as to declare that American soldiers should be treated not as enemy combatants, but as traitors, and thus were denied many of the protections that were afforded to prisoners of war by international custom. Wallabout Bay off the coast of Brooklyn was filled with the hulks of more than a dozen so-called prison ships, ancient vessels too decrepit to go to sea. Conditions on board were unspeakable, with reports that thousands of Americans had died of starvation, disease, and exposure. Captured Britons were treated more humanely by the Americans, but only to the degree that supplies permitted. This was wartime, after all. It was hard enough feeding one's own army, let alone some 7,000 enemy troops. It would be a tremendous relief to be rid of them. But of course, that wouldn't happen if the British did not consent to release a compensatory number of captured Americans. The negotiations had progressed well, with General von Niephausen proving more amenable than General Clinton to divesting himself of the responsibility for thousands of captured Americans. No doubt, as a mercenary and someone with no national loyalty to England, he took the rebellion less personally than did General Clinton, who seemed not to care how many American boys died on his watch. With spring approaching, and with both sides in need of more troops for the resumption of hostilities, von Niephausen requested a personal meeting to move the negotiations forward. General Washington refused to meet with him, on the grounds that von Niephausen was not his equal in rank, and it would be beneath him to parley with an inferior. His Excellency directed Alex to go in his stead. Alex was torn about the mission. It was, in its own way, an even greater responsibility than command of a regiment, with perhaps 20,000 lives hanging in the balance. Yet Alex was tired of telling powerful men how powerful they were. It would be tedious work, more a matter for an accountant than a statesman, with dozens of egos to play off and assuage. He longed for the straightforward heroism of combat. And he also wanted to be away from Morristown, with its constant reminders of Eliza and her upcoming nuptials to Henry Livingston. But General Washington's directive was not a request. It was an order. Alex had no choice but to delay his journey to Carolina. So on a chilly morning in early April, accompanied by Lieutenant Larpent acting as his secretary, Alex set out on horseback for the town of Amboy, New Jersey, a bucolic hamlet at the confluence of the Raritan River and Arthur Kill, across from the southern tip of Staten Island. It was a ride of less than 30 miles, which would take no more than 3 or 4 hours on horseback, depending on the condition of the roads. Along their journey, the crisp air was laced with chimney smoke and the smell of the morning's bread. Housewives and maids tossed seed to chickens, gathering the eggs into their aprons. Farmers set off armed with muskets for hunting or axes for felling trees. From a distance, the men and women might have been mistaken for married couples. But on closer inspection, the males were either very young or very old. Every man of fighting age was off at war. As they trotted past yet another frame farmhouse set back from the road, Lieutenant Larpent eyed a shapely milkmaid dragging a stool toward the cowshed. Larpent slowed his horse to a walk.
"It's hard to believe there's a war going on, if you ignore the fact that we're in uniform, I mean."
Alex spoke sharply to the listless soldier.
"Were you speaking to me, Lieutenant Larpent?"
From the corner of his eye, he saw Larpent sit up straighter in his saddle.
"Sir, I said, Colonel Hamilton, sir, that it's hard to believe there's a war going on. Everything seems so peaceful, sir.
Alex smiled out of sight of the lieutenant's eyes. He had learned from General Washington to ignore the temptation to fraternize with those beneath his rank. It only made it that much harder for them to accept one's orders when the time came. Though Washington often referred to Alex as my boy, he had never referred to him by his Christian name or offered Alex permission to call him anything other than Your Excellency. Alex had adopted the policy for himself. If anything, he found it even more necessary than did General Washington, for he had not the latter's family connections and long history to fall back on to command respect.
"Aye, Lieutenant. It's a beautiful morning. Let's hope the day ends on a high note as well." "Do you think Niephausen is serious about exchanging prisoners, sir? It's hard to believe, given General Clinton's refusal to do so, that he would allow one of his subordinates to act in his absence." "General von Niephausen tells me that he has full authority in this matter, and that General Clinton is eager to be rid of the headache."
He shrugged.
"I'd say the chances are 1 in 2 that he'll bother to show up, and 1 in 10 that he'll agree to an exchange of any consequence. But it is worth the effort, given the thousands of lives that hang in the balance."
They mulled over the subject until it was exhausted, then lapsed into a companionable silence. Alex's thoughts flitted back and forth between the praise he would elicit from General Washington, should he succeed in negotiating the prisoner exchange, and images of Eliza's face framed by an ivory wedding bonnet saying, "I do," but not to him. A half hour passed before Lieutenant Larpent cleared his throat and said,
"Pardon me, Colonel Hamilton."
Alex roused himself from his thoughts.
"Yes, Lieutenant. I was just wondering, sir, whether you knew when we would be getting back to Morristown. That is, will it be by tomorrow night, sir?" "I cannot say with certainty, Lieutenant. If, as I suspect, this is just another overture, our business may well be concluded by the evening, and we can return first thing tomorrow. But General von Niephausen placed no constraints on our discussion, and if the conversation goes well, it could take several days or more to work out a large-scale exchange."
Lieutenant Larpent sucked in a breath. Alex resisted the desire to scold him.
"Have you pressing business back in Morristown, Lieutenant?"
"Well, not exactly, sir."
"For some reason your 'not exactly' sounds unerringly like 'exactly.'
I..." "Sir?"
Lieutenant Larpent had clearly not understood Alex's wit.
"What is it that you need to get back to Morristown for?"
Lieutenant Larpent opened his mouth, then snapped it shut. After a long moment, he said in a guilty voice,
"Oh, it's nothing, sir." "Lieutenant, don't make me order you." "It's just a, well, it's a party, sir."
Alex's eyebrows raised. He had not heard of any upcoming party for the officers, junior or senior.
"Is there a birthday among the ranks?"
Not exactly, sir."
"Lieutenant."
Lieutenant Larpent sighed heavily.
"It's more of a, well, a send-off, sir."
"I was not aware that any regiment besides the 3rd had been given marching orders. I would hate to think that a party is being thrown for my own men and I was not invited."
"It's not that kind of send-off, sir."
"My God, Lieutenant. I think you should take my place in the upcoming negotiations with General von Niephausen. You can withhold better than anyone this side of an Algonquin brave."
Another squirming sigh from Lieutenant Larpent.
"It's more of a party, sir." "A party? What on earth could the men be celebrating?"
Suddenly, Alex understood. It was a party for Henry Livingston to celebrate his upcoming marriage to Eliza Schuyler.
"I'm sorry, Colonel Hamilton. I shouldn't have brought it up.
Alex wasn't in the mood to be charitable. Indeed, you should not have, Lieutenant Larpent. We are on a mission of state. There are thousands of American soldiers festering on British prison ships whose freedom depends on what we do in the next several days, and you can think only of getting drunk on cider and sherry.
With all due respect, sir, that's not why I'm sorry I brought it up. I'm sorry because I know how much you love Miss Schuyler, sir.
Alex whirled on Larpent, ready to lash out at him. But the face he saw staring at him sympathetically wasn't that of an underling, but that of a boy a few years younger than him, who felt keenly the heartsickness of an admired comrade. Alex's rage melted on his tongue. He brought his horse up beside Larpent's.
At ease, Lieutenant. I confess I have been rather on edge this last week.
He managed to laugh.
So, you feel my pain, do you? But not so much as to decline the invitation of my rival.
Lieutenant Larpent risked a chuckle.
As you said, Colonel, there will be all the cider and sherry you can drink. It's been a long winter with nothing stronger than the corn mash 6th Massachusetts brews behind the Langley's barn. A man has to treat himself once in a while.
Alex nodded.
Well then, let's get a move on, and I'll do my best to get you back in time to the celebration.
He spurred his horse, and Lieutenant Larpent kicked his up beside him.
If it makes you feel any better, Colonel, he said, as they galloped toward the river. The troops all think Colonel Livingston's nothing but an empty purse, and you can be sure I'll be drinking his liquor all the while, and having him on in your stead.
28. Hen Party. The Cochrane Residence, Morristown, New Jersey, April 1780.
Oh, Eliza, isn't it thrilling? We're going to be sisters. It is a prospect almost too delicious to contemplate.
Kitty Livingston, Henry's older sister and Eliza's friend since the earliest days of their childhood, had been tasked with throwing Eliza a little celebration of her own. And here it was, coming off as something of a failure. Due to such short notice and Kitty's lack of acquaintance with the local mademoiselles, she had been unable to round up any guests besides herself and Peggy and Aunt Gertrude, who was now sleeping soundly over in the wing chair next to the fire. To make up for the lack of guests, however, Kitty had dressed herself in enough fashion for 10 women. Her wig was so tall it would have made Madame de Pompadour jealous, and her heavy makeup was done in exquisite grisaille. Her face and décolletage had a silvery sheen, so that she looked like Pygmalion's statue of Galatea come to life in all her perfect beauty, polished yet nubile. Her dress was a separate work of art. Acres and acres of laurel green silk moiré embroidered with the most ornate arabesques of saffron and oxblood, the tones muted yet exquisitely deep, like sugar candies tinted with mint and lemon and cherry. The bustle was 3 feet wide and the skirts twice that, so the only spot she could find to sit was in the middle of Aunt Gertrude's longest sofa, which was so crowded with Kitty's dress that no one else could join her. Eliza thought perhaps Kitty had done that on purpose.
"Can you imagine, Eliza?" trilled Kitty. "One day soon we'll be able to send out invitations that proclaim, Catherine and Elizabeth Livingston and their husbands wish to invite you to Liberty Hall to officially open the season at Elizabethtown, and Catherine and Elizabeth Livingston and their husbands invite you to—" "But, Kitty," Eliza interrupted her, "if it's Catherine and Elizabeth Livingston and their husbands, won't your surname be necessarily different after you marry?"
"Oh, I've already thought of that. I've always said that I'd refuse to marry anyone less distinguished than a Van Rensselaer or a Livingston. Or maybe a Schuyler, though Philip is a little too young for me to wait around for," she added with a wink at Eliza. "And since Peggy seems to have snatched up the Van Rensselaer to have,
I've set my eye on a couple of cousins on Papa's side. Oh, Kitty, Peggy said with a laugh, you speak of a husband as though he were a long-term investment, like a parcel of land to be cleared and sowed with some slow-growing orchard crop. And isn't he? How old was Stephen when you began to reel him in? 11? 12? You have been playing that boy as expertly as a courtesan. Kitty, Eliza clapped her hand over her mouth, you go too far. You think I'm speaking ill of dear Peggy, but I'm complimenting her. Your sister will be the richest woman in the United States. If, she added slyly, she can ever get him to propose. And what makes you think he hasn't? Peggy said coyly. Like Kitty, she had gone full stop for tonight's party. Even though the ever-thrifty Catherine Schuyler had slashed her daughter's dress budgets, Stephen was constantly sending his beloved bolts of the most exquisite silks from Europe. Her dress tonight was made of a shocking orange damask, a color that Eliza would have thought no living girl could pull off. Yet Peggy had gone the extra mile, having her maid dye her hair with ancient Egyptian henna, giving it dramatic umber tones. Piled up high, it sat atop her head like the crest of some exotic bird from the jungles of South America, perhaps, or one of those elegant long-legged cranes that wade through the shallow waters of southern wetlands. The summery palette highlighted the rosy hue of Peggy's skin, which was sprinkled with enough flecks of mica to rival Kitty's silvery sheen.
"Has he proposed? Oh, do tell," Kitty urged, jumping ahead of herself. "I know he is not yet of age to access his fortune, but you could always elope like Angelica did and wait until he is 21. That is, assuming his parents don't disinherit him."
"Disinherit him?" Peggy said. Eliza was unclear if her sister was outraged or merely pretending to it.
"For marrying a Schuyler?" Peggy laughed out loud. "The Van Rensselaers should be so lucky as to join their family to ours."
"Aren't you already related to the Van Rensselaers, on Mrs. Schuyler's side? Or perhaps Mr. Schuyler's, or both?" asked Kitty.
"Mama was a Miss Van Rensselaer, and of course a Livingston on her mama's side. Papa's mother was a Van Cortland, not a Van Rensselaer."
Eliza couldn't help but laugh. "Oh, dear, we are so related, it is a wonder that we do not turn into those poor Habsburgs, marrying cousin after cousin until we start giving birth to misshapen idiots." Eliza had meant her words to come out in jest, but there was enough truth to them to cause Kitty and Peggy to stare at her in incredulity.
"Oh, Eliza, you are too morbid even for yourself," Kitty said at last. "Come, let us have a bit of fun, as I know my brother certainly is."
Kitty was referring to Henry's festivities, which were going on in full force near the officers' barracks several blocks away. Henry had invited every officer from the rank of lieutenant on up, some 100 men, most of them under the age of 25, and all eager for one last party before the war went hot again with the return of warm weather. Earlier in the day, when she was out for a stroll, Eliza had seen dozens of casks of beer, cider, and sherry being rolled into the long stone barn that housed the sea infirmary. Curious enough, she had peeked in, only to find that all the beds had been cleared out. The four cast-iron stoves had doubled to 8, and large stacks of firewood were piled beside each of them, enough to heat the large space moderately for a week, or to keep a single party raging all night long.
"Pardon me, Corporal," she'd said,
pulling aside one of the enlisted men setting up the party.
"But where have all the patients gone?"
The corporal had blushed deeply.
"You will forgive me, miss, if I decline to answer that question on the grounds of decency."
"And you will forgive me, Corporal, if I tell my fiancé, Colonel Livingston, that you declined to assist a lady."
"Ah, Miss Schuyler, I didn't know it was you. I do apologize."
He blushed.
"Colonel Livingston had us take the sick to the house on White Lawn.
The house on...
Eliza's jaw dropped.
You mean the one on the corner of Ferrier Street?
Aye, Miss Schuyler. Now, if you'll excuse me, Colonel Livingston said that if we get the party set up by sundown, he'll let us have a cask of cider for ourselves.
Eliza? Kitty's voice cut through her reverie. Are you all right? Or is it just the thought of the momentous cusp you stand upon that has you so preoccupied?
Dazed, Eliza looked up at her friend, her cousin, her dreadful fiancé's sister.
Cusp, she repeated. A cusp is the top of a hill whereupon one can see clearly in every direction. This is not a cusp. It is a cliff, a drop into some unfathomably deep and foggy abyss, and below it all, I hear the thunderous roar of waves crashing upon rocks, like those that dashed Prospero and Miranda upon Caliban's island.
Eliza,
Kitty said sharply, placing her hand on her friend's knee.
You are overwrought. I tell you, you must calm down, dear. It is a marriage, for God's sake, not a shipwreck.
Isn't it, though?
Eliza said glumly.
Sister, Peggy spoke up, you insult our cousin. It's acceptable,
Kitty said, though the color had come into her cheeks, visible even beneath her makeup.
I understand that you haven't known Henry long enough to love him. I even know that Henry can be difficult. But I promise you, I know all his secrets and his weaknesses, and once I've shared them with you, you'll have him under your thumb in no time. And Papa is grooming him for a career in politics, which means that he'll spend most of his time in Philadelphia or New York or wherever they decide to place the capital, so you'll hardly have to deal with him at all.
But is that what a marriage is?
Eliza said.
Learning how to manage your husband so that he doesn't oppress you. Praying for his departure rather than yearning for his return.
My word, Eliza. Everyone always said you were the sensible Schuyler sister,
Kitty laughed.
And here you are, mooning about romance like some latter-day Juliet. Listen to me, cousin. We live in a new country, a country that will be larger than any in Europe by 3 times, and with unlimited possibility for expansion. And we are our country's gentry, its kings and queens, princes and princesses, dukes and duchesses, its barons and earls, and
I am quite familiar with the order of ranks, Eliza snapped.
She did not appreciate the turn this conversation had suddenly taken.
Then you are also familiar with our responsibilities.
Kitty fluffed up her enormous flounces.
Yes. We command great prestige and power and wealth compared with the rank and file, but we also owe a duty to our position in society. The common man and woman are free to marry whom they choose based on nothing more than base physical attraction, but we are bound to make unions that preserve our fortunes and estates, which provide the structure and indeed the occupation on which plebeian lives depend.
Peggy tittered.
Indeed, Eliza said, turning to her sister. And no offense intended, Peggy, but I've heard Stephen wax on about his holdings and tenants more than once.
No offense taken. He does tend to go on and on about the patroonship.
But, Eliza continued, turning back to face Kitty, isn't that what we're revolting against? The unfair advantages of aristocracy? The tyranny of a distant king deciding one's fate based on what suits his interest rather than one's own.
You talk of politics, Eliza. That is men's business.
Kitty took a long pull from her glass and banged it down on the side table.
We are women. We tend to the home front.
And why should that be? Eliza demanded. This is a new country, as you say. Why shouldn't it have new laws, new customs? And why should not those customs extend to the home itself? To love?
For the first time this evening, Kitty's expression cracked, though her makeup almost managed to conceal it.
I sense your heartache, Eliza, she said finally. The news of your flirtation reached us, too. You mourn the loss of a great love that you think could have surmounted the difficulties of rank and fortune. And I agree. He is quite a charming bastard in every sense of the word. However, I must point out that Colonel Hamilton never proposed to you. You may have thought love conquers all, Eliza Schuyler, but he knew the rules of the game.
Eliza steeled herself for Kitty's next words.
And the truth is, dear sister-in-law, even Alexander Hamilton realized he wasn't good enough for you. 29.
Tortoise and Hare. Continental Army Headquarters, Morristown, New Jersey, April 1780. The meeting with General von Niephausen had been a wash. Alex was unsure whether the acting commander even bothered to come to Amboy. But when it was conveyed to the British contingent that Colonel Hamilton would be negotiating in General Washington's stead, a terse note arrived from the British warship docked so boldly offshore. General von Niephausen would not meet with anyone other than General Washington. To parley with an underling was beneath him. It was, Alex reflected, the same language General Washington had used when he refused to meet with General von Niephausen.
These aristocrats, Alex thought with some annoyance. Their infatuation with rank and face make their own lives ridiculously difficult. And even worse, they don't recognize how it inconveniences the lives of the rest of us.
Although in the case of thousands of prisoners of war, inconvenience seemed like a deeply inadequate term. While generals and colonels jockeyed about whose sleeves were decorated with the most epaulettes and tassels and stripes, as if rank were measured in gold thread, their privates and ensigns and corporals huddled in rags in prison cells and work camps. All in all, not a great day for diplomacy. But what made everything worse was that now he had no excuse to stay away from Morristown, which meant that he would be in town when Eliza married that Livingston bounder. Not in the actual church, perhaps, but it was right across the square. And he would hear the bells ringing and see the throngs of well-wishers cheering on the new bride and groom from his windows. He tried to delay the journey back to headquarters, but Lieutenant Larpent was in such high spirits about making the night's entertainments that he wouldn't be held back. And Alex, though miserable, was not so mean-spirited that he could spoil his assistant's fun just because he himself was not going to partake. It rained the whole way, adding insult to injury. The roads were a soup of mud, and even though their mounts were as eager to be out of the chilly drizzle as their riders, they refused to move beyond a canter, lest their hooves slip out from under them in the mire. The journey to Amboy had taken but 3.5 hours. The slog back to Morristown took more than 6. By the time the men arrived, they were sodden and iced to the bone. Alex charged the grooms at the stables with brushing out their weary mounts until they were thoroughly dry and serving them a double ration of oats. And then he and Lieutenant Larpent hurried as fast as their chilled bones would carry them to the Ford mansion. Despite the exhaustion of the journey, Larpent was still excited for the party, but all Alex could think about was grabbing a few bites to eat and crawling beneath the covers. Alas, when Alex and Larpent entered the Ford mansion, they found it deserted and frigid, the fires gone cold in their grates. The larders had been stripped bare of comestibles and beverages. Even the bottle of cognac Lafayette had given him before he went off had been pilfered from its hiding place beneath a loose floorboard in his bedroom. When Alex was absolutely certain that there was not one thing to eat or drink in the house, nor even a single coal to start up a fire, he turned to Lieutenant Larpent with a rueful smile on his face.
"Permission to speak freely, Lieutenant?"
Larpent looked at him with confusion. Alex was his superior officer. He need ask for nothing from him.
Permission granted, sir,
goddamn his soul to hell,
Alex said, and collapsed atop his bed.
Oh, sir, Larpin cried out. Buck up, sir. It's not so bad. Here, look. Just let me get some tinder, and I'll have a fire going in no time.
He raced from the room and down the stairs, returning shortly with a tinder and twigs. Alex hardly noticed him. He had shucked off his wet coat and rolled himself in his blanket like a caterpillar wrapping itself in silk, his head buried beneath his pillow. With one half-open eye, he watched as Larpin knelt before the grate, expertly arranging wood shavings and splinter into a neat cone, and then striking the flint against steel in steady streams of sparks. The men had lit a lamp when they came in, yet Larpin seemed content to start the fire from scratch, and on just his fifth spark a little glow appeared in front of him. He blew on it gently. The glow grew and sprouted a little tongue of flame. Larpin fed splinters of wood to it, with the delicacy of a farmer feeding an abandoned weanling, then twigs, then small branches. Within minutes, a small fire was crackling in the grate, and a pile of larger logs suggested that the blaze would grow to a conflagration quickly.
I must say, Lieutenant, you light a fire with admirable alacrity. We didn't have servants to light fires for us when I was a boy on the farm, sir. As the younger, I was charged with lighting the stove in the mornings while my father and older brother tended to the cows. No mother to attend to the task? Alas, sir, my mother died giving birth to me. My father never found a suitable replacement.
Alex could feel the fire warming the tip of his nose, which was all that poked from the covers. He pushed the pillow back, feeling the warmth on his cheeks, his forehead.
I, too, lost my mother when I was very young, though I was blessed to have her in my life for its first decade.
Larpin nodded.
I sometimes think that's worse, having a mother, than losing her. My older brother and father miss her to this day, whereas I only wonder what she would have been like. Excuse me, sir,
he said then, and walked quickly from the room. He was back a moment later with a pair of towels.
If we don't get out of these wet clothes and dried off, we'll catch our death of cold.
Alex knew he was right, but part of him didn't care. He had failed at today's mission, had failed at securing a command, had failed at winning the hand of the girl he loved. When he came here as a 14-year-old, he had been told by everyone he met that he was going to be a great man. But all he had managed to become was the secretary of a great man. Larpin went to look for dry clothes and came back several minutes later, dressed in a mismatched and somewhat ill-fitting uniform.
Cadged from Weston's, Tillman's, and McHenry's tack, I'm afraid,
Lieutenant Larpin explained.
Not even General Washington himself could command me back into my own uniform. Now, let me see if I can find us some provisions,
he said, and left the room. Alex changed out of his wet garments and into the dry ones. He was a miserable human being still, but at least one who didn't feel like a drowned rat. Larpin returned with a frown.
Not much here, but salt beef and crackers, he reported.
Alex didn't respond. A moment later, Lieutenant Larpin cleared his throat.
I say, sir, why don't you come along to the party? There'll be food there, and wine, and good cheer, and you look as though you could use all three.
Alex couldn't help but laugh.
Go to my rival's pre-wedding celebration. Yes, that does sound like a fine time. You won't have to see him, Colonel. The party's in the barn by Gareth's field. It's a huge building. You can keep as far from him as you like.
Alex just laughed again. But then something came to him.
Wait, you said the barn by Gareth's field. The stone barn? Yes, sir,
Lieutenant Larpin answered.
But that's the barn being used as the sea infirmary, is it not? Yes, sir. It's my understanding Colonel Livingston had the wards moved to Miss Jane Daudry's establishment for the evening. too. A brothel?
Alex roared. Are you joking with me, Lieutenant?
No. Sir, Colonel Livingston said that even the sick and injured need to have some fun.
This is outrageous, Alex said, jumping up and dropping his blanket and rushing to his wardrobe.
I'll have him court-martialed. I'll have him flogged.
He stopped in front of the open doors.
I'll call him out.
Sir? The shocked word dropped Lieutenant Larpent's lips like a dribble of chaw.
I'll call him out.
Alex hurriedly pulled on his pistol.
I'll challenge him to a duel. Don't you see? If he's dead, he can't marry Eliza.
Sir, please, Lieutenant Larpent said. Calm down. I don't know that a breach of protocol, if that is indeed what you are calling him out for, necessitates a duel, sir. Isn't it simply something for a military tribunal?
Then I'll make him call me out, Alex declared. I'll go to his own party and insult his honor and integrity in front of his own guests. He'll have no choice but to challenge me to a duel. You know these milquetoast aristocrats. They cannot bear to lose face in front of their peers, but even less so in front of their inferiors.
Sir, please, Lieutenant Larpent pleaded as Alex stuffed his feet into his boots. I don't think this is a good idea. It will look like... Alex turned sharply on the lieutenant.
Like what, Lieutenant? He demanded.
Larpent's chin trembled as he answered.
Like you are manufacturing a reason to duel him. Like...
Larpent bit back a gulp.
Like murder. It's not murder if he calls me out, Alex said, striding from the room. It's proof of how unsuitable a mate he is for any gentlewoman. Arrogant, quick-tempered, foolish.
Forgive me, sir,
Larpent panted as he hurried along after Alex.
But do you not see how all those words could describe you in this moment, sir? She chose him, sir. For whatever reason, she accepted his proposal and not yours.
Under ordinary circumstances, Alex would have wheeled on the man and dressed him down until he was a quivering ball of jelly. But Larpent was right. Eliza had accepted Livingston's proposal while he, Alex, had never even proposed. It suddenly dawned on him. That was it. He had never told her what he felt about her. He had never formally presented his suit, never courted her properly. He had let her sister cut him to the quick, and Angelica was right. He was penniless, without a name or family. Who was he to think he could be worthy of such a girl as Eliza Schuyler, an American princess? But the thought of that bright, wonderful girl marrying that slug filled him with an intoxicating brew of anger and hope, that he picked up his pace, grabbing his damp hat from the tree in the hall and dashing out the front door. Maybe it wasn't too late. Maybe he could still do something about it. Call the man out. Duel him for her honor. It was his last chance to save Eliza. To save himself. But the day wasn't done with him yet. After a brisk, rain-soaked trot of some 20 minutes, Alex and Larpent reached the stone barn, his assistant pleading with him all the while to see reason. Alex burst through the doors into a throng of men in various states of disarray and undress. The cavernous space blazed with heat from Colonel Livingston's appropriated stoves, and a spicy fog of alcohol and sweat laced the air. The revelers were clustered in three distinct throngs. Alex scanned the leering faces, looking for Colonel Livingston's, but saw no trace of him. He made his way to the second group of men, then the third. But though he saw two scantily clad lasses dancing for tips and kisses, he found no trace of Henry Livingston. Suddenly, Corporal Weston's face appeared before his. His cheeks were rosy with heat, and his speech was addled by alcohol.
"Colonel Haddleman," he exclaimed. "I mean, Curling Hellenom. You made it to the party."
He grabbed Alex by the shoulders and would have bestowed a slobbery kiss on him if Alex hadn't pushed him back.
Corporal Weston, he demanded. Have you seen Colonel Livingston?
Corna who?
Livingston, Alex shouted, trying to make himself heard through the noise of the fog and Corporal Weston's drunken stupor.
Corna Livingston?
Corporal Weston laughed.
Never met him.
He held up his glass.
But I'll drink a toast to him. Here's to Corna Livingston, whoever he is.
He swilled a gulp of some frothy lager. But this is his party, Alex persisted.
Livingston's party? Oh, right,
Weston said, nodding his head enthusiastically. Where is he, then?
Not a clue. He's gone. Definitely gone.
Gone? But isn't he to be married to Miss Schuyler tomorrow? Alex demanded, his frustration rising.
Miss Schuyler,
Corporal Weston, his eyes lighting.
She's a beauty, isn't she?
And then, unbidden,
she eloped.
What? Alex gasped. It was Miss Angelica Schuyler who eloped. I refer to Miss Elizabeth Schuyler.
Don't tell me no,
Corporal Weston said with great outrage.
I know Miss Angela Beth, Miss Elizica, Miss...
He took a deep breath to steady himself.
Miss Elizabeth Schuyler. And I know she eloped, gone since yesterday morning.
Alex could only stare at the corporal in shock. Miss Elizabeth Schuyler, he said at last. Eliza. She's already married. You are certain? Corporal Weston nodded cheerfully, as if he were delivering the most felicitous news in the world.
Miss Schuyler, he said dreamily,
even as his eyes flitted to one of the dancing girls who had wrapped her shawl around the waist of a shirtless soldier and was using it to pull him behind her toward a ladder that led to the hayloft.
Wouldn't have minded a trip to the hayloft with the general's daughter myself.
Alex's jaw dropped open, but his fist was faster. A moment later, Corporal Weston was sprawled unconscious on the stained planks of the barn floor, a drunken smile still plastered across his rapidly swelling lips. Alex stared down at the man in surprise. He had not thought that punching a man in the face would make him feel better, but in fact it had. Pivoting on his heel, he stalked out of the barn into the rain. 30. Taking Liberties. The Cochrane Parlor, Morristown, New Jersey, April 1780. The party, such as it was over. Kitty Livingston's coachman, who had spent 6 hours asleep in a shroud of blankets, had been awakened and clambered sleepily up into his box, to save Kitty the trouble of having to walk a quarter mile to the house she was staying in with her brother and mother, who had come west for the wedding. She had taken Peggy with her, saying Eliza needed a bed to herself on last maiden night, while Aunt Gertrude, who had had perhaps one glass of Madeira too many, had taken herself rather unsteadily up to bed, while Eliza remained downstairs to supervise the lone housemaid still awake in the clean-up of the party. There was little to do. Dinner had been eaten and cleared more than 4 hours earlier. The furniture was pushed back into its usual arrangement, the coals banked in the fire. And then Eliza had urged Louisa to get a few hours' sleep before the madness of the wedding day should dawn. She, however, remained in the parlor, which was still quite warm, and, taking the lamp near a bookshelf, rummaged through until she came across an edition of Richardson's Clarissa, which she and Angelica and Peggy had taken turns reading aloud to one another some years ago, when they felt the first stirrings of romance in their hearts. She pulled the first volume from the shelf and flipped through idly for some minutes, until at length a passage leapt out at her, bold on the page despite the dim light cast by a single wick.
I declare to you that I know not my own heart if it not be absolutely free. And pray let me ask, my dearest mamma, in what has my conduct been faulty that, like a giddy creature, I must be forced to marry? To save me from what? Let me beseech you, madam, to be the guardian of my reputation. Let not your Clarissa be precipitated into a state she wishes not to enter. Eliza sighed. She remembered the passage well, of course. She and Angelica and Peggy had each taken turns declaiming it, competing to see which of the three could be the most dramatic, the most forsaken, the most imploring. Now she wondered whether the passage had appeared as some kind of sign, telling her to follow the truth of her heart and flee this marriage, or whether it was simply the idle workings of her mind, looking for an author's eloquence to express feelings she was too despondent to put into words. She could run, she told herself. It would be like Angelica's elopement, except instead of an escape to marriage, she would escape from marriage. The Schuylers had not the ready access to cash they had had before the war, but there was still enough money to get her to Philadelphia, where she could find Angelica and John Church and persuade them to let her reside there until such time as Henry had abandoned his suit. She would take a job, as a governess, perhaps, or a schoolteacher, or even as a lady's maid. She would depend upon neither father nor husband to determine the course of her life. She would be free to pursue those great inalienable rights that Mr. Jefferson had enshrined in the Declaration of Independence. Her own life, her own liberty, her own happiness. But even as a brand new sort of life flashed before her eyes, like a series of paintings in a gallery, she knew the images were no more real than pigmented oils applied to canvas. She was Eliza Schuyler, after all, the middle sister, the sensible one, whose intelligence was steady where Angelica's was cunning, whose beauty was human where Peggy's was statuesque. She was the daughter of whom Papa had remarked when she was but 7 years old, "A part of me does not mind if I never have a son because I have Eliza. She has a boy's fortitude and ingenuity without the terrible vanity that afflicts our sex." Even after Philip was born and had lived past the childhood illnesses that took almost half of the Schuyler children, Papa always said to his namesake and heir, "Take care that you follow your sister Eliza's example, and you will never bring shame on the family name." Because when all was said and done, she was a Schuyler, and she was proud of it. Her family had been present at the birth of this country under the Dutch, and had seen it through its first great political upheaval when the English took over, and now were seeing it through to independence. She didn't want to run from that legacy. She wanted to add to it, to build on it, to help make the United States be what it wanted to be, a place where all souls, black as well as white, and female too, could realize their full potential regardless of the circumstances of their birth. So she would not run. She would stay. She would do her duty. She would hold her head up high, and no one would ever reproach her. And would it be so bad? Eliza understood that Angelica had chosen John Church not for his jawline or waistline, but because he was attentive to her and would give her access to the society she craved. They would build a good life together, the life that Angelica wanted. And Peggy had been corralled into allowing Stephen Van Rensselaer to court her for 2.5 years now, though he was too young and too earnest. Yet he did dote on her, and he was kind. And when they finally married, Peggy said, it wouldn't be a case of two strangers awkwardly maneuvering around each other, but of two friends progressing in a relationship that had developed for years. Although in this case one of the friends had carefully shaped the other into exactly what she wanted in a mate, certain that he would treat her as the drone treats the queen bee, attending to her every need. Eliza was twice as resourceful as Angelica and Peggy,
If they could mold their men, then why couldn't she? But the heart of the matter was simple. She didn't want to marry Henry Livingston when she was desperately, helplessly in love with someone else. Someone who, while he had wooed and whispered sweet nothings into her ear and had hinted at the depth of his feeling and affection, had never declared himself, had never asked her aunt and uncle for permission to court her, and as Kitty had pointed out, he had never proposed or made his intentions clear. His reputation preceded him. Alexander Hamilton was a tomcat and a flirt. And she had fallen for him anyway, but it didn't make a difference, as he was nowhere near. He was gone. To the 3rd New Jersey Regiment, to battle and to glory. Had left town without looking back once. Such thoughts as these were flitting about her head when she heard a sound in the rear of the house near the kitchen. One of the servants, she thought, sneaking in for a bite to eat now that the mistress is asleep. Or who knows, maybe it was Kitty and Peggy. But a moment later, she heard a heavy clatter of crockery, and even through 2 closed doors, a pained curse followed by a self-mocking laughter. Eliza placed her book down and took her lamp to the hall. Cool air swirled about her, and she pulled her shawl over her bare shoulders and chest. "Hello?" she called in a low voice, not wanting to wake anyone upstairs, if indeed they had not been awakened already. The kitchen door swung open, and a man's face appeared. It staggered unsteadily toward her. But only when it was a few feet away did the light reveal who the visitor was.
"Why, Colonel Livingston, what on earth are you doing here?"
"Besides being intoxicated," she added to herself. Henry placed a sweaty hand on the wallpaper to steady himself.
"What, Eliza? Have I wandered into the wrong house in error? All these colonials look the same."
But even as he said that, a smile flickered across the edges of his mouth, and she knew he was pretending.
"I think you should not be here, Colonel. It is bad luck to see the bride before the wedding, for one thing. And for another, we have a long day tomorrow, and both of us could use some sleep to restore us from the excesses of our celebrations."
"Celebrations, eh?"
Henry slurred.
"We had some hot chocolate," said Eliza.
"Chocolate? Of course. Eliza, the sensible Schuyler. Plain dresses, no wigs, not even a bit of décolletage to give us something to look at."
And as he spoke, his free hand darted forward and swatted at Eliza's shawl, dragging it roughly from her shoulders.
"What? I spoke too soon. Look at those. I had not realized you were so blessed."
Eliza knew she should be shocked, yet she felt an eerie calmness descend upon her. Henry's actions were so far beyond the pale that condemning them was almost beside the point. What she needed to do was disarm him.
"It is quite chilly here in the hall. Let's go into the parlor, where the fire still burns. I can make you some chocolate."
Without waiting for answer, she turned and headed back into the parlor, fixing her shawl as she went.
"Chocolate? No thanks," Henry groused, falling onto the sofa where Kitty had held court less than an hour before.
"Miss Livingston was nice enough to bring several tins from her latest trip."
"Kitty?"
Henry's head whipped back and forth, as if his sister might still be in the room.
"She is overfond of European luxuries, that one. I tell you, Liza, if there's one thing I'm looking forward to at the end of this war, it's kicking out all the foreigners, all the Brits and Germans, and especially the French, with their dandy men and frosted women. Give me good, solid, earthy American men and women, unpowdered, unwigged, and hell, unwashed."
Eliza winced inwardly at Henry's profanity, but kept her face calm.